The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today's guest, before we go to him, I have to ask you why you were thinking that you wanted to talk to this man. This is a person who has thought much more broadly than just the next moment or the next week or the next month. What's going on with interest rates tomorrow, or why did gold drop today? This is a person who's thinking in generational terms. Do you want to tell us why you're wanting to talk to Jim Rogers?
Kevin, if I'm ever talking to someone who is under the age of 25 and trying to figure out why they should be interested in economics or finance, I usually refer them to Jim Rogers' book, The Investment Biker, partially because it's an adventure story of a guy who opts on a BMW motorcycle and travels the circumference of the world.
Which sounds, I mean, if you're below the age of 50, that sounds romantic. It sounds like the way to really learn something, doesn't
it? To be honest with you, it is the best primer in terms of economics and financial understanding. Of course, it's not balance sheet accounting. It's not, there are places that you can go to refine a certain set of skills. But in terms of a backdrop of understanding, he covers a lot of really solid things in that book.
It seems like it beats a Harvard MBA, too, where you're sitting in a classroom all the time. You're actually out there getting gritty and getting dirty.
Well, and that's not to say that Columbia, where Jim has spent some time teaching, is the better place to go rather than Harvard. But I would say that sitting on the back of a BMW motorcycle is going to teach you a lot more, perhaps, than sitting in a chair there at Harvard Square. So, Kevin, it's interesting. We have competitive currency devaluations immediately in front of us. We have trade wars pending. We have a lot of things that are beginning to work themselves into the evening news. And to be honest, the only people that I want to talk to or get opinions from are people who have a sensitivity to history, have a sensitivity, and have succeeded in the marketplace because of their background and the insights that they brought to the table. That's Jim Rogers working with George Soros Quantum Fund. That's him working on his own through the decades following that. Literally, Kevin, making a fortune as he looked at macroeconomic trends, global macro thematics, applied them, and stayed ahead of the curve. Well, this is a man who I think in terms of identifying trends and transitions has done a very skillful job.
One thing I really appreciate Jim Rogers, and you do too, is basically he looks at the short term when he needs to. I mean, let's face it, last week China did a couple of things that definitely affected the markets, and he's looking at that. But he's also looking at the broader picture and saying, what does China look like in 2030? What do commodities look like in the next 5 to 10 years?
The other thing, Kevin, that I really appreciate is that as we've talked to Otmar Issing, formerly with the European Central Bank, and Stephen Roach, still with Morgan Stanley,
right,
Jim Rogers as well, what I find, particularly in Rogers' most recent book, A Gift to My Children, Father's Lessons for Life and Investing, is a certain reflectiveness. Looking back at both a professional career, one that he takes great pride in, and also looking at some of the more basic things in life that he values deeply, as Otmar has and as Stephen Roach has expressed too on this program.
David, one of my favorite portions of the Otmar Issing interview, going back a few months, was when he actually became reflective, and he really was hoping. You know, we talk about him being one of the key issuers of the new European Central Bank and the euro. But in reality, what he was trying to do was avoid the horrors of what he had seen earlier in his generation with World War II. He really thought and thinks still that the euro was the only hope. And you look at Jim Rogers, he really wants to leave a legacy or a message for the next generation.
Well, Kevin, as you know, we've discussed issues with academics, with business leaders, with bankers, with politicians, both foreign and domestic, and we've found that the closer you get to the realities on the street, the closer you are getting to the truth. It reminds me almost of a Mark Helprin novel where there was an economist paid to travel and observe common things on the street, and those conclusions drove macro conclusions which he shared with his firm. There's two people, not now fiction, but in reality, who in my experience and professional career have encountered, who are exactly like that Mark Helprin novel. Jim Rogers and John Templeton, both big picture thinkers, interestingly enough, both spent time at Oxford and appreciated sort of an international bent in their thinking. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Dave. By the way, John Templeton was also from a small town in the South. He happened to be from Tennessee. I happened to be from Alabama. We both went to Yale, and we both went to Oxford. In fact, we went to the same college at Oxford. He's a lot smarter than I am, but there are some coincidences.
Politics, philosophy, and economics, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, you wrote A Gift to My Children, A Father's Lessons for Life and Investing, and this is something of a departure, but not really, from the different books that you've written in the past, whether it's The Adventure Capitalist, A Bull in China, The Investment Biker, which is where I think I first got to know you many years ago. And, you know, this is certainly more of exactly what the title says, A Gift to Your Children. To be honest with you, I'm more interested in what you would want to share with them than what you're usually interviewed on, whether it's on Bloomberg or CNBC, where the questions are usually fairly tawdry, and you do your best to give an answer to something that's been pre-programmed by a producer hours before with really no relevance to what's actually happening, whether it's with a business balance sheet or, you know, tied to current events. Why did you write this? And if you had to sum it up, what's the most important thing here for your girls?
Probably the most important thing for anybody, but for my girls too, is to learn to think for yourself. It's extremely hard to do, and probably throughout history it's been hard to do. You know, as famous general once said, when everybody's thinking the same way, it means nobody's thinking. And he was exactly right. It's very hard to sit and say, wait a minute, the emperor has no clothes. It's very hard to sit and figure out what's really happening. And it's so easy just to follow what you hear in the media or elsewhere. So for them to question everything, be skeptical, think for themselves, beware of the boys. I mean, these are a few things I wanted them to know. I used to be a bad boy myself, so I know.
Well, you did spend time both at a great school here in the States and at Oxford. I spent some time at Keble College. I forget what college you were at Oxford. But between that, Yale, travel, business experience, where do you think you lean most heavily in terms of that independent mindset?
Well, I guess seeing the world probably is pretty helpful in learning to figure out what's going on. Rudyard Kipling once wrote a poem called The English Flag. He had a line in there called, "What can he know of England who only England knows?" In other words, you'll know a whole lot about England or your own country or any country if you travel around and see other countries. You'll learn a lot about yourself, about the world, and everything else. So I guess that, if nothing else, you know, I was yanked out of a small town in Alabama and dragged off to the Northeast. And that alone, not so much where I went to school, whether the school was good or bad, just the experience of, you know, being yanked away and having to see entirely different things, that set me thinking. Then the same thing when I went overseas to school and traveled, this probably more than anything else taught me to think or made me realize, hey, wait a minute, I got to figure this out for myself. I can't rely on other people.
You've repeatedly said that history and philosophy are two areas that you would spend time studying. I assume that you did informally and have continued to informally, but formally did in your studies at Yale and Oxford as well. What is it about history and philosophy that you think is so important?
History will teach you that no matter what we think today, Dave, it's not going to be true in 10 or 15 or 20 years. You've got to understand that the world is always changing, and no matter how fast a belief or a thought process you may have, examine it. Pick any year you want, Dave. Pick 1900 and look at the world 20 years later. Look at 1920 and look at the world 15 years later, 10 years later. It was entirely different from what everybody presumed in 1920. 1940, 1950, you pick the year, and you cannot believe how much the world changed, no matter how firm people's opinions and beliefs were in 1950. The world was not that world in 1970. So that's what history, one of the things history teaches you. And of course, philosophy teaches you to think. I was not very good at philosophy when I was at university, but in years after, I started realizing, oh, now I know what they were talking about. Now I see. So it took me a while, slower than most, I guess. But then Learning to think for yourself is extremely important.
Well, that was an asset to you with the Quantum Fund. That was an asset to you as you retired early. It's been an asset to you through the years, decade by decade, as you've looked at various themes, call them secular trends, if you will, and have identified them, perhaps ahead of time, and have rode them very successfully as an investor. What are the secular themes that you see playing out today? We would guess the answer you would give is a dollar bear market, is perhaps a stock bear market, depending if you're pricing it in gold or the dollar itself. A commodities bull, you're assuming that you're still on that theme from the book that you've written and the various interviews that you regularly do. But perhaps you could talk about the secular trends that you see in motion and why you continue to see them from this point forward.
Well, you mentioned a couple. There is no question in my mind that the bull market in commodities is continuing. There's been very little productive capacity added for decades now, 30 years, 25 or 30 years. You know, the recent unpleasantness in the world, financial world, means that there's even less supply coming on stream. Many people who in 2007 or 2008 thought they might add capacity have changed their minds and not doing it. You know, they're all saying, see, we told you. We told you this was not going to last. So there's even less supply coming in the future. The commodities bull market is in continuance. If the world economy gets better, Dave, then you're going to make a lot of money in commodities because shortages are developing. If the world economy does not get better, we'll do better in commodities because they're going to print money. That's all they know how to do. Now, printing money is bad for the world. But, you know, the people at the central bank in the U.S., for instance, don't know any better. Mr. Bernanke spent his whole career studying the printing of money. So he will print even more money, as he's already said. So the commodities bull market has a ways to go. There is a currency problem developing. We have imbalances, great imbalances in the world economies. The U.S. is the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. The U.K. has gigantic debts. You know who and where the debtors are. Well, the creditors are mainly in Asia. The largest creditor nations in the world are China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore. And usually this kind of imbalance gets sorted out in the currency market. So we're going to have more problems, more turmoil, I should say. The U.S. is a terribly flawed currency. I don't think anybody would dispute that. And it's getting worse. So the problems with in the currency markets and with the U.S. dollar are going to continue. There will be rallies in the dollar, no matter how bad things are, and there always are rallies in every bear market. But for the most part, people need to figure out how to play the currency markets because it's going to affect them. Many countries in the world are already saying, oh, we've got to do something about the dollar. You know, Brazil, China, Russia, I mean, lots of people are saying, oh, gosh, what do we do? And so that's going to be an ongoing problem. There is a shift in the world from the U.S. to Asia. That's another major trend that's taking place. I just got through saying the major creditors are all in Asia now. The major debtors are in the West. There is, in my view, there's a shift away from financial centers to the producers of real goods. We've had long periods in history when the financial types were in charge, in the center of everything. And then we've had shifts when the people who produced real goods, whether it was farmers or miners or lumberjacks or whatever, were in charge. That kind of shift in the 80s, 90s, and this decade, financial centers were in charge. And now it's shifting back to the producers of real goods. Everybody listening to this show should become a farmer if they really want to have a great next 20 or 30 years.
Well, your emphasis then is on real things, whether the economy gets better and you're talking about supply and demand dimensions directly in the commodities market, or the economy gets worse, both here in the U.S. and globally, and the response to that is monetary inflation and a repricing of commodities in those new dollar, yen, renminbi, what have you terms, you're really still talking about one thing, which is real things.
Well, yes, no, I guess the underlying theme of what's going on, as I said, there is a shift from the financial types to the producers of real things, and it's being reflected in many ways, not just cities, not just currencies, not just economies, but it's everywhere. Economics underlies just about everything. many people have said, you know, figure out the money or follow the money and you'll figure out what's really going on. Well, figure out the money and you'll become a farmer. I'm not going to become a farmer, by the way, Dave. I don't think I'd be any good at it, but for people who are so inclined, that's probably a great future.
That is a lot of folks in the South that have a green thumb. Jim, the question that comes to mind, I sat at lunch with four gentlemen on Tuesday, Felix Rohatyn, Bill Fleckenstein, James Grant, and a very successful business operator out of Europe. Most of his business is in North Africa, dealing with cobalt, nickel, copper, iron ore, and his primary partners and joint venture partners are in Asia. There was a strange dichotomy because on the one hand, you know, Felix's views, as he expressed, were the most bearish he's been probably in his life. And Jim Grant, when I was asking him about, you know, how we settle the $2.5 trillion in debt that the U.S. has to roll over in addition to the budget deficits that we continue to run, but $1 and $1.5 trillion a year currently, you know, he said, Dave, I'm just as bearish as I was. And I'm thinking to myself, is this the new reality? That the financial centers, as well as those who are closely connected to the financial centers, Felix Rohatyn of Lazard, James Grant, I'm sure you know, Bill Fleckenstein, there really is a change of the guard, influence, power, opportunity when it comes to finance, as opposed to, you know, perhaps the other gentleman who was at the table, who in fact is sitting on three continents, business operations in London, assets in Africa, and business partners in Asia. There really is the dichotomy, isn't it?
Well, one certainly needs to be more and more international in the 21st century than even the 20th century, or in any century. I mean, there have been many centuries when world trade has expanded and there's been internationalization, but it's going to be more and more going forward as we speak, even if the politicians try to mess it up. There's no question. The shift is taking place. I said before, we're shifting from finance to producers of real goods. We're shifting from the U.S. to Asia. You know, in 1918, the United Kingdom was the largest, richest, most powerful country in the world. It just won the First World War. If you looked at a map of the world, it was red because the British Empire was everywhere. But within, you know, one generation, it was a basket case, and within three generations, it was bankrupt. They had to be bailed out by the IMF. The country which was three generations earlier had been the richest, most powerful country in the world, totally bankrupt in three generations.
That brings the dollar into my mind. No one can imagine a world without the dollar as the world's reserve currency. This remains a linchpin in the structure of global finance. And perhaps you could explore how it could, in fact, be removed, what might take its place. Maybe what we're dealing with is a failure of imagination. There is no, perhaps without that sense of history you just mentioned, in three generations something can be utterly turned upside down. What would take away, what would jeopardize that reserve currency status?
Well, first I want to say that in 1910, nobody could have conceived that anything would be the world's reserve currency except the pound sterling. In 1910, the U.S. was still a debtor nation. So, I mean, whoever would have thought in 1910 that the U.S. would emerge in the 20th century? I mean, some people, but there were plenty of candidates for who would emerge in the 20th century. There, I don't see many serious competitors right now for the dollar. I mean, if the U.S., if there were an earthquake tomorrow and the U.S. fell into the sea, the world would start using the euro because there's nothing else. The euro has its own flaws and its own potential problems, but right now it'd be the euro. But in 15 or 20 years, I don't know, Dave. The only conceivable candidate 20 years from now would be the, if it's not the euro, would be the renminbi, the Chinese currency, but that's a little bit absurd to be talking about in 2010. It's still a blocked currency. I mean, you can't even buy and sell it. Now, they're opening it up. They have been opening it up for 5 years. Not as fast as I would open it up, but who knows in 15 or 20 years. The only thing I can see potentially is the renminbi. But a lot of good things have to happen for that to occur, too, and a lot of other things have to change. This is not a simple life we live.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
We had a recent conversation with Stephen Roach, and he has spent the last couple of years on the ground there in Asia, specifically in China, with Morgan Stanley. And he underscored the importance of the development of a social safety net in China alongside the move from an export-driven GDP growth to an internal consumption model. And, you know, upon reflection, it seems like that's an 8 to 10 year process. And I'd be interested in your opinion, do the Chinese have that kind of time? Maybe they have all the time in the world, and we're the ones who keep on shrinking time unnecessarily. But is there time enough for them to transition as they need to?
Well, Chinese history would indicate that they have lots and lots of time. The Chinese have always thought in terms of decades and centuries, whereas we think in terms of the next quarter, the next election, fortunately or unfortunately. Now, yes, there are problems in China and short-term problems in China, but they do seem to think much further into the future than we do. They save and invest. They don't, in my view, they don't really need a social network, a social safety net that quickly, because they do save and invest over 35% of their income. That's the safety net right there. We in the U.S. save and invest 2% of our income because we have these, partly because we have these government safety nets. So even if there's a collapse in China, there are huge amounts of pent-up savings that would see them through for a while. If it's a real bad collapse, then of course there'll be cries for the government to step in and help, just as there always have been throughout history all over the world. But I think they have more time than just 8 or 10 years if they need it, even if there is economic upset.
In that economic upset is likely to hinge on what's happening in real estate and the coastal cities, as I understand it?
Well, yeah, there is a bubble in urban coastal real estate in China, but it's not everywhere in China. Metro real estate hasn't done so much at all. It's not like in the U.S. The U.S. had a credit bubble where people could buy 5 or 6 houses with no money and no money down and no job. And then the banks, you know, bankers took the mortgages and sliced them up even more and made them even more leveraged. That's not happening in China. There's a price bubble. Prices are too high, but that's entirely different from a credit bubble. I mean, in China, you cannot buy 5 or 6 houses with no, you can't buy 4 houses with no job and no money down. And nobody's out there taking the mortgages and slicing them up and leveraging them even further. So there are going to be some bankruptcies when the real estate bubble pops in the urban coastal cities, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Guangzhou, whatever. Some people will suffer. But the Chinese economy is a lot more diverse than that, and it won't have the same effect it had in the U.S., where essentially all growth for 10 or 15 years was just in the financial sector and mainly in housing bubbles and consumption bubbles.
I assume you follow Jim Chanos and some of his opinions on China and Asia, but China specifically?
Oh, sure.
The conversation I had with him this last week was interesting. You know, and he shared some things with a larger group as well, that 5.8 billion square feet of new development was what was in the works in 2009 across China, with vacancy rates rising anywhere from 12 to 17%, depending on Shanghai or Beijing. Granted, those are only two cities of monstrous country. But his impression was, and I, you know, honestly, Jim, I haven't spent any time on the mainland, so I really have nowhere to go with this. And this gets back to that issue of travel and being able to think through these things with actual experience, on-the-ground experience. But his impression was that the bubble there in real estate was 1,000 times the size of that of Dubai. Now, that's probably a bit of hyperbole, but Dubai was credit, wasn't it? And you're saying China's different, there's a bubble, but it's not the same thing.
I know, and like and admire Jim, but I'm afraid he has been totally wrong on China. As you know, he's been saying this for well over a year now, and it hasn't happened the way he said it was going to happen. And the idea that the Dubai situation was Dubai's economic model was to build an economy and a nation built on real estate speculation. I mean, that's all they had going for them. They didn't have much else. And for Jim to say that China is 1,000 times Dubai is embarrassing. Much as I know and like him, because the Chinese economy is very diverse. There's lots of things in the Chinese economy, and there's nowhere near. Yes, there's a bubble in some cities, but the idea that the Chinese economy is 1,000 times Dubai, as I say, is downright embarrassing as far as I'm concerned. And yes, I've said before, there are going to be some real estate dealers going bankrupt in China. One thing about China, another contrast with the U.S., you know, in the U.S. we built a lot of stuff and there was really no ultimate demand for it. In China, yes, they've overbuilt. I said there's a bubble. But there is an ultimate demand. There are 1.3 billion people in an economy which is growing pretty rapidly. Maybe they've gotten ahead of themselves in real estate, and they certainly have as far as I'm concerned. But that does not mean that 3 years, 5 years, 13 years from now, there won't be the demand for all that space. But you cannot say that in the U.S. because the U.S. didn't have the kind of demand growth and population growth to fill up all those speculative houses. So there are many very serious differences with China and certainly with Dubai and even with the U.S.
As a long-term issue, and going back to that idea of a secular trend, there may be some cyclical downturns, but you still see that as a secular trend and something that, whether it's a 20, 30, 50-year time frame, is very, very relevant to an investor's thesis moving forward.
Yes, but I mean, remember, we can't all sit here and invest for 2030. It's 2010. If we go bankrupt in 2011, it doesn't much good in 2030 if we would have been okay. But I would remind you that in the U.S., you know, in the 19th century, we were a huge debtor nation. We had 15 depressions with a D. We had a huge civil war. We had very few human rights. We had periodic massacres in the streets. We had little rule of law. You can still buy and sell congressmen in the U.S., but in the 19th century, they were cheap. You could buy four or five for what it would cost you today to get one. And as recently as 1907, the whole U.S. system went bankrupt. I mean, Washington was broke, New York was broke, everything, Wall Street was broke. And yet, out of that, we had a very, very successful 20th century. So China's going to have plenty of setbacks. I don't know what or when, Dave. They're going to have horrendous setbacks along the way. But in the end, I would expect China to emerge from this much better than most countries. My daughters speak Chinese. If China suddenly has a massive demonstration in Tiananmen Square, a huge economic setback, I'm not going to stop teaching them Chinese and start teaching them Danish or something, because I still see that China will come out of all this better than nearly any other country in the world.
Well, you're right. There is a lot of things that can happen between now and then, many future contingent events. Closer to us, kind of right under our noses, are the brewing sort of trade wars. And a lot of this comes back to currencies. We've seen the currency here in the U.S. depreciate by 10 to 15% since the middle of summer. And, you know, as a result of that, of course, there's folks who are up in arms. We've seen the Swiss spend a year from, you know, March of 2009 until just recently trying to manipulate their currency lower for a trade advantage. This is the Swiss. But at the same time, we've seen, you know, Thailand and Brazil, those with a fiscal responsibility, leaning heavily on those with a monetary responsibility to depreciate. You know, a race to the bottom. Is this inevitable? Is this something that we're now sort of in a, for lack of a better word, a maelstromic vortex?
I suspect we are. I don't like saying it, but, you know, in the 30s, we had this huge trade war, which led to the collapse and then the Second World War. And after the Second World War, everybody said, well, we're never going to let that happen again. And they set up GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and started opening up the world to free trade and no more currency protectionism. At least they began dismantling all that. Unfortunately, all those guys are dead nowadays, you know. And the politicians we have these days don't read history, and they don't understand how this always ends in disaster. No country's ever won a trade war. Everybody loses in a trade war. But they're emotional and worry about the next election. They don't read their history. They've got their own constituents. And none of them have the courage, unfortunately, to stand up and say, guys, we can't do it that way. You already see the finger pointing, the bashing. That just makes it worse instead of better. And by the way, we, the U.S., more or less started this. You may remember a few years ago, the Chinese tried to buy a small oil company in the U.S. And the U.S. went up in arms and said, no, you cannot. And then Dubai, our fastest ally in the Middle East, tried to buy some of our ports, and the U.S. went up in arms and said, no, you cannot. So then other countries started saying, well, you know, if America says you can't use U.S. dollars to buy what you want, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to protect some of our industries. We're going to protect some of our sectors of the economy. and now it's spreading everywhere. It's not good for the world, and I would like to think that somehow sanity is going to return, but I don't see any sign of it. The Chinese are making mistakes, we are making mistakes, everybody's making mistakes, and they're piling on instead of going the other way.
Well, recently, Robert Mundell, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, was interviewed on Bloomberg, and he said that, you know, the current state of monetary affairs was not only dangerous, but, you know, he said, we've never been in this unstable of a position in the entire currency history of 3,000 years. So this isn't sort of your, you know, offbeat cranks concerned about hyperinflation. This runs the gambit from market practitioners, academics, people who are on the street and seeing inflation, whether it's, you know, the cost of corn and wheat, given supply and demand issues, or a repricing of assets due to a diminished purchasing power. The question I would have for you, the question I would have for Felix Rowe Hatton or James Grant, y'all have been around and y'all have read. Grant, I've learned a lot from that man. How do we move forward without ending in a 1914 style solution? Because honestly, that's what happens when you get to the end of a globalization cycle, is things tend to get nasty. Trade wars turn into other kinds of wars. And I don't want that. You know, nobody wants that, but nobody is sensitive to the outcome of bad policy decisions today.
Well, and throughout history, wars have started because of bad policies. Politicians make mistakes. And then they blame it on other people, or they blame it on foreigners. They never take the blame for themselves. And the next thing you know, 19-year-old kids are out there shooting each other. And you should worry. I worry. You said nobody wants a war. Of course they don't. But we've been having wars for 30,000 years, 50,000 years, as long as the history of time. And I'm afraid we're going to have more. Someone did a study, not me, but did a study which said that throughout history, when you've had shortages of raw materials, it's always led to war. Now, I haven't done that study, but it makes logical sense that that would happen. We certainly have problems with commodities, shortages of commodities now, so it could very well happen again.
Well, Jim, bringing us full circle, you wrote the book, A Gift to My Children, Father's Lessons for Life and Investing. If you were filling a library or selecting just 5 or 10 books to go into a library for your girls, you know, education is a part of what you desire for them. Travel, languages, exposure to history, philosophy, literature. What would some of those books be that you would consider foundational, hopefully, to their character formation and intellectual prowess?
Well, as I said before, I hope they would read as much history and philosophy as they can, especially history, and I would ask them to read about the rest of the world. I'd really ask them to travel to the rest of the world, to see the rest of the world. There's nothing like seeing the world close to the ground and from the ground up, nothing like crossing a border in a jungle, a frontier border, and trying to figure out a way to get to town and find yourself a place to sleep and find yourself some food or fuel or whatever it takes to learn about the world. So if they can't do that, I would certainly ask them to read as much about the rest of the world as they can, having read some history and a bit of philosophy.
Well, for our listeners who don't know what that allusion may be to, you've been around the world multiple times, and not just on a jetliner. Taking a BMW motorcycle around the circumference of the globe gives you a certain ground level view, and then you did it by vehicle as well, four-wheel instead of two-wheel. And so you have seen the world and have a unique insight into that. Jim, your website is jimrogers.com?
Yes, jimrogers.com.
And for a review of some of the books that you've read, some of the investment insights that you've given, and certainly a preview of the book you wrote a year or so ago, A Gift to My Children, would encourage our listeners to take advantage of that and go to jimrogers.com. Jim, I appreciate your time with us, and next time I'm in Singapore, perhaps we can have a cup of tea or a glass of wine. I've taken your advice. My oldest son has been around the world with me twice, and he's just getting ready to turn 5. So if we're back again, perhaps we can meet at the Raffles for a cocktail.
Well, by all means, bring him along, and he and my little girls, I've got a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old, so by all means, we can let them speak Chinese to each other or practice Chinese.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Good enough, Dave. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
David, what a fascinating guy. I mean, let's face it, we've been talking to people all around the world, but the kinds of people that actually make the most sense are the ones that have common sense. David, you're going to be traveling to Costa Rica next week, and I know you're going to be talking to some people who've been considered experts in their field for the last 3 decades.
Kevin, Jim mentioned Rudyard Kipling's The English Flag, and can't help but think of the Gods of the Copybook heading. And as we look at current events today, although things are very different and times do change, there are also a number of things that are very similar to the past. And we see the burnt, bandaged finger wobbling back to the flame. The Institute for International Finance, this last week, Kevin, $825 billion they expect to flow into emerging markets over the next 12 months, $272 billion coming into emerging market debt, up 42% from last year. And Kevin, I mean, this is the exact kind of thing that feeds into trade wars and currency wars. It's the same kind of inflows that we saw early 90s in Mexico, leading up to the tequila crisis in 94, where that was the tipping point. In Asia, specifically Thailand in the mid-90s, leading up to the tipping point in 1997, where you've got these massive amounts of speculative dollars, and this being forced because of low interest rates, both in here and in London and in Tokyo. We've got an unhealthy macroeconomic picture, and unfortunately we're not seeing things resolve themselves in a healthy fashion.
Well, and like Jim Rogers said, you know, those imbalances are actually solved in the currencies, but ultimately they lead to trade wars, which ultimately lead to wars themselves.
We've got some friends, long-term friends, going back 30 years, who've spent a lot of time in the currency markets, and in the coming weeks we'll be visiting with them as we go to Costa Rica. So we look forward to those conversations and the many questions that we continue to have, whether it is along the lines of economics, finance, politics, or geopolitics.
That's just one more reason to keep listening. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Give us a call or join us on the Internet. The phone number is 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. We'll be right back.